This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Richard Wollstonecroft. We're going to be going over the MUF recap as well as some current events. Richard, great having you back on.
Pleasure, boys. How are you? You're over in Southern California, are you?
Yeah, I'm also joined here with Matt Pegas.
Hey, how's it going?
We are
in smoky Southern California, or I think my area is far more smoky than Robert's, but it's been a wild week
no,
here.
No, mine was last winter. My area is pretty, it's fine.
I've heard it's on fire, California, at the moment. Is this correct?
Yeah, that is correct. I mean, several fires across the state. You have some bad ones up north, and you also have some very bad ones down here. Near where I live, Malibu is basically burning to the ground, ostensibly, so it's... Pretty wild, and yeah, I can smell smoke when I step outside.
Well, I mean, yeah, Colin Liddell at Affirmative Right, I think in traditional news on the two websites, he did something. He's got a very cheeky sense of humor. He's like, "A world mourns as Malibu burns to the ground."
Yeah, well, this fire is affecting me, and I'm in no way praiseworthy of it or anything like that, but it is easy to have, I guess what you call the cheeky sense of humor about it, because a lot of the damage down here is damage to, not necessarily the nicest celebrities' houses burning down, like Miley Cyrus's and such, so there is some trauma for it.
House burned down, did it?
Yeah, Miley Cyrus, Kanye West, who I like more, but, definitely a lot of real estate just burning to the ground, and thankfully, only a couple of people have died in the Woolsey fire, which is down here. The campfire up north in California seems a lot more tragic, where the death toll is like 42 and like just people didn't stand a chance.
While we may joke, it's obviously a tragedy what's going on in California at the moment, and we wish our friends the best there, and we hope they get it under control. Is there rumors that these fires have been started by illegal immigrants? There's been a rumor of that, or that this has kind of been some kind of...
Well, just to be clear, if there are rumors like that, I don't think they're substantiated, but I think as of right now, they're not really sure.
But you can
don't necessarily...
How,
yeah.
You could see how Muslim terrorists, radical Muslim, radical Islamic terrorists, and it's only got to take one in the area, can weaponize something like the environment to turn, basically a dry environment into a weapon, and that's yet another way we have to watch what goes on in our own countries at the moment. I mean, obviously that's happened a couple of times in Australia as well. Obviously there are a number of bushfires in Australia that are natural, but every now and then there's a suspicious one, and the authorities generally locate someone in the area who's been acting a bit suspiciously. So every now and then you get someone who's, using it as a weapon. Either they're pyromaniacs or they're terrorists, so it's one of the two things.
I personally think the Wrath of Keck is a better possible explanation for the Malibu fire, but...
consider the Keck, these things. He's a power not to be messed with, and I think in the midterms, he will be very unhappy with the result in the House.
Yeah, and we have Governor Newsom now, so it could be a response to that. I am, of course, kidding.
Did Soros rig all the machines? What happened?
No, California has been extremely liberal for, a decade or several decades at this point.
Why? This makes everyone poor. Even the people there who are Mexican, the people there who are African-American, they're going to do a lot worse under a kind of globalist regime. It only benefits like wealthy celebrities, as far as I can tell, this kind of globalist regime and the actual globalists themselves.
Yeah, it's California.
I guess the propaganda is convincing.
Yeah, for sure. California has like the worst income inequality in the entire nation.
Yes, but Gavin Newsom has said that he wants it to lead the way for the nation going forward post-Trump. So I guess he wants to export that income inequality is maybe how we should look at that.
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, it seems like a blatant offer in relation to actual real equality. I mean, they have all that bullshit new left equality, which is all that, you know, their version of, you know, of kind of identity politics, which is basically replacing, I guess, traditional ideas of Marxism. Leftist Marxism or leftist socialism, if it was to put into practice, actually maybe improve people's local unions, things like that. It seems like the left doesn't have anything to do with that anymore. But anyway, moving on from that.
Yeah, we'll definitely get to these political themes when we talk about the other topics. So I want to get to the midterms and some other political news. Let's talk about Muff. So Matt and I had our film Supply. And we got our supply. We got the Best Guerrilla Film Award at MUFF, so we're now officially MUFF alumni.
You're officially MUFF alumni. Congratulations, boys. You know, there's a big hand from down under on your win. Congratulations. You know, the former winner of that same award is James Wan, who went on to create the Saw franchise, which is the greatest horror franchise in cinema history. So I see great things ahead for you two. You've got
Wow.
You know, make some big documentary or something, or, you know.
It's the bill.
He went and did The Conjuring, and he's directing the new Aquaman, James Wan, so he's going on to do great things. So I see good things for you boys, you know.
And what were some of the responses from people in the audience? I mean, obviously, Richard, you're a little bit biased because you know us, but just from people who are totally unbiased.
People were both fascinated by the character of Luke Ford and by the character of Robert Stark, who they thought was a real character. I think, you know? It was on a good day of the festival. That was probably the busiest day of the festival. That was the day of the Steve Bannon trumpet war. So it was just time before that. So we had a lot of people come down. We had a lot of the Patriots from the local, you know, we had a few, cause, you know, we were a bit concerned there might be an Antifa presence on this particular day. So we had a lot of Patriots down, a lot of people from, different, you know, various right-wing and patriot groups who were there. So they saw your film and really enjoyed it, and then they stuck around and watched Steve Bannon's and then Laura Southern. So it was quite a busy day at the festival, so I think, you know, it was a good day to be on.
I mean, just curious, what specifically do they say about my character and the Ford character?
I think they thought you were characters, basically, you know, and that it was an interesting kind of examination of the ideas of Luke Ford and also your kind of hero-worshipping of him. You know, it works as both serious political commentary, but it also has a kind of slightly comedic element, I think, to it.
Yeah, I was going to ask. I mean, I hope it got some laughs. I mean, I personally think the film is funny, and I'm proud of it, but some of it's a little esoteric and, like, kind of inside joke, so I didn't know if it would land. But
funny, don't worry. You guys come across as funny. Don't worry about that.
Well, there are political scenes, but they're more... it's not explicitly political, like, obviously, Steve Bannon's film is... it's implicit political themes within both the psychological themes and the aesthetics and cultural themes. Like, give some examples. Obviously a big part is the theme with Luke Ford, but there are these themes throughout the beginning of the journey, which are, I mean, about this kind of struggle for status and me reading passages from my book, but they're definitely relevant to that. But we made it, I think we said this in our last show, we made a conscious decision not to make it political, or explicitly political.
I think it was a really interesting triple feature. You know, each film, even though I guess it could be considered of the new right, each film was really quite different. You know, I mean, your film was very idiosyncratic and was very personal in a way, and it did really deserve, I think, the best guerrilla film, because it was a guerrilla film. It used that kind of low-budget aesthetic that I kind of really admire, that I even used a little bit on The Second Coming, Volume 1 and 2. So, you know, I think it used that interesting aesthetic, and it was idiosyncratic. It had a sense of humor. It wasn't taking itself too seriously. But I think it was also, you know, an interesting, you know, like, Luke Ford is an unusual character. He's not someone who, it's not like you're worshipping Milo, you know what I mean? You know, it wasn't your typical figure from the new right that you were obsessing over. it was Luke Ford, who's a particularly interesting figure in Australian politics. And he's
so you're saying he's known in Australia, or not really?
Not really, but like he's known within the new right, the alt-right community a bit, you know. And I think he's probably known better overseas than he is locally. But obviously, a few people know him, and I've never had a problem with him. I did a podcast with him once. I can't remember what it was about, but we did one together, and we've always got along, and I have no problem with him. And I think it's great what he's into, and I've always found his ideas refreshing and his perspective, you know, also, you know, always new and interesting. And same yourself, really. So I think it was a good kind of cross-watering of your two interests, and I think it came together well. And then it was, you know, followed by Steve Bannon's thing, which was fairly much almost like a propaganda video for the terms. I mean, even I mean that respectfully. You know, it was just a really good polemic, you know, about what was interesting about Trump, why it was important for, you know, Republicans to get out and support him. And obviously we see the results now. I mean, Trump held the Senate but then lost the House. Well, I think for an incumbent who's been had, what, 90% of U.S. media attack him every single day like he is Saddam Hussein or Osama bin Laden. I mean, it's been unbelievable, the hostility towards Trump. He seems to be doing a lot of good things for America. It's extraordinary the way that the press seems to be lying about him every day. So I think, you know, Bannon touched on a lot of that and put together a really interesting 70, 80-minute kind of documentary about that. We gave him Best Director and Best Documentary when I've been in contact with Steve Bannon's camp. Hopefully he'll produce a thank you video. His manager said he would, but we haven't got around to it yet. Maybe he won't. But it'll be great if he did. We'd love to put that online on Facebook until they remove it. And then Southern's Farmland, which is a really kind of wake-up documentary about, you know, the attacks that have been going on white farmers in the post-Mandela South Africa. And obviously it's a warning to all European countries. What happens when we lose demographic or when we become a minority in our own countries, essentially?
We already are in California, but it's nothing like it is over there.
Yeah, it will give it time. I mean, it wasn't like that instantly for us white South Africans either. It was... What, I mean, how long has it been since Mandela took over?
Is it 94?
Mandela took over early 90. So 25 years from now, yeah, you know, they'll probably be, you know, coming for you with a machete, but for now, you're okay.
Have you been to South Africa?
I've been to Africa. I've never been to South Africa. I'd like to go. I had a director of my Melbourne Underground Film Festival, Eugene Grobler. He was a South African immigrant. He left South Africa around the time Mandela came in because his family just said, well, we're all going to be murdered if we stay here. I mean, they weren't a racist family at all. They were just basic white South Africans. But anyone with any money, and this is what he told me, he said anyone with any money got out as soon as Mandela, within 5 years. They knew that while Mandela was still alive, that they had time to get out because they knew that the people within Mandela's party who wanted to murder all the whites wouldn't do it while Mandela was alive. So basically there was a kind of window of opportunity for white people to leave South Africa. But as soon as Mandela died, they were all in trouble. So my friend's family got out in the 90s. So, you know, and this is a general feeling among white South Africans. Obviously, there are some that have stayed there who are very wealthy, who feel they can protect themselves, and there are some that can't afford to leave. And I think there's a strong case that we should accept some of these people as refugees, because there might be actually refugees we might want, because they're people who have suffered at the hands of... you know, the multiculturalism gone awry. Let's just say that.
Well, there was a Australian politician, Peter Dutton, who proposed that, but that was struck down by the Prime Minister.
Yes, at the time, and that Prime Minister has been replaced since then. That Prime Minister was Malcolm Turnbull, and we recently had a little coup d'etat within the Liberal Party, which is the ruling right-wing party. They're like the Republicans, I guess. In Australia, and a guy by the name of Scott Morrison has taken over. He's really not that different to Malcolm Turnbull, but as I said, we did have a recent terrorist attack in Melbourne, and we're a famous restaurateur, Sisto Malaspina. Sisto Malaspina was murdered by a Somali Muslim immigrant. He was basically stabbed to death in Bourke Street, and a car bomb that... Well, basically it didn't go off properly. The car was burning, but the actual bomb itself didn't explode. So, I mean, I was actually walking on that same street about an hour and a half before it happened. So, like, if I decided to, you know, moved my plans by an hour and a half, I would have been walking along the street at the exact same time all this happened. So, you know, it's a real wake-up call, I think, to a lot of people in this country, and everyone's extremely upset because Sister was a huge part of our culture. It was one of the most popular restaurants at the top of Bourke Street, and everyone's in deep shock at the moment, and a lot of people are really beginning to question the wisdom of Islamic immigration and obviously the dangers of radical Islamic terrorism.
And obviously in Europe, these kinds of attacks have been pretty frequent, so... Well, I'm not shocked what's going on in Europe because it's expected after the migrant crisis and in the United States as well. But in the case of Australia, how shocked were people? Is this like relatively new or has there been a lot of problems prior to this?
There was, about this time last year, there was a fellow, he was sort of an immigrant, but his exact ethnicity was, I'm not sure. He had a kind of Greek name, but you know, he was from somewhere like Libya as well, or I don't know if exactly, it was from somewhere in Northern Africa as well. So he had an interesting kind of mixture of ethnicity, but he had recently converted to Islam and he'd burned the Christian Bible and he tried to kill his brother who was a homosexual. And then after that, he took to his car, drove down Bourke Street, which is the exact street where this last attack happened, and ran over about, I don't know, three or four different people, tried to kill people by running them over, and that was another shocking attack. And he was recently charged and sentenced to life in prison. The verdict for that came in the last few days. So, yeah, I mean, there's been a number of these attacks, and Australians have a lot less tolerance for this kind of bullshit. We're very much a no-bullshit kind of people, and I think, you know, I mean, I'm pretty well-known on Facebook for my comments, and it was just interesting basically to see my whole news feed turn into me, basically. Everyone was expressing views that were like mine, like literally everybody.
Has Australia taken in a lot of refugees from the Muslim world in the sense that Europe has?
We are a lot luckier than a lot of other countries. I would say the Muslim population in Australia is only between 5 or 10%. So I think that we're going to be okay. If we were to cancel Muslim immigration, now I'm sure that the 5 or 10% who are here, we would be able to integrate and we would, you know, I think there's a call now to deport any refugees who are waiting to receive citizenship if they have expressed radical opinions. I think that Dutton, who you mentioned before, has floated that. And I think ScoMo, Scott Morrison, that's his nickname, ScoMo, he's come out and quite bravely laid this at the door of the local Muslim community and said, listen, you know, what's going on here? What's all this bullshit? And you need to help us identify who these radicals are, because this is not working and things are going in a very bad way. And I think, you know, someone needed to say that. No one's had the guts to do it, but Scott Morrison recently did that, so I applaud him for doing that.
What are your thoughts on Steve Bannon's ongoing work in Europe with these different populist and nationalist political movements?
I think that's a fantastic idea. I mean, I really applaud Steve Bannon for doing it. I think someone needs to do it. I think it's clearly a movement. I mean, one of the things that really interested me when the new right appeared, you know, I guess also the alt-right as well, to some extent, was, you know, I mean, to me, it wasn't just about America. It was an international thing, you know. And to me, I know Richard Spencer, with his interest in the alt-right, he has a more, how would you call it, Daily Stormer 1488 version of it, which I think is a huge, huge tactical error to make at this stage, because the movement was receiving, I would say, at least a widespread interest from a lot of different people. So for him to really drag it to the margins of the far right, the extreme right even, was a huge mistake. Because really, something like the alt-right or I think the new right to a certain extent, which is a broader concept, it should definitely be supporting, you know, this new right-wing nationalist populism, which, I mean, in many countries is achieving a kind of, you know, polling about 40 to 50% of the vote, you know what I mean? Which means it can win elections. I mean, you know, Richard Spencer's version of radicalism polls like 1% of the vote. This kind of radical, Jew-hating bullshit that he likes to go on about. You know what I mean? Like, that's worth 1% of the vote. But this kind of, you know, populist, that basically means that if you're from a country and you're a nationalist, doesn't matter what ethnicity you are, doesn't matter what religion you are, if you're proud of the country you are now in, and you support, you know, like, nationalist economic policies the way you see Trump advocate, you know, then you're a nationalist, you know, and that you also, there's a kind of divide between the globalist way of looking at things
which is the flood. Our countries with cheap labour, lower our wages, lower our standard of living, and also change the culture irretrievably to something that's just like this grey nowhere land.
So that event, so there was, well, the screening at the night, so it was Steve Bannon's Trump at War, Lauren Southern's Farmland, and our film Supply. So that night had a general political theme. So you're saying most of the people attended were from political backgrounds, or were those, it was also the people who were there to see the other films?
There was a normal MUF audience, which supports independent cinema. And then on top of that, it was like, I guess, maybe another 20 or 30 people who are from the Patriot community. So it was a busy screening. We had about, you know, 60 or 70 people for each film, probably with the last film getting the most, around 100, Farmlands. You know, I think a lot of people wanted to see that. So, you know, it was a good evening, and we're proud of it. And we didn't get a single protester, not a single one. We couldn't believe it. We did hold the event a bit further out of town than most of our events at the Melbourne Underground Film Festival normally. Right in the heart of the CBD, which is the central business district, right in the heart of the city. But this one we held in a suburb. Basically, we did it mainly because we thought, well, you know, basically protesters won't come down here. And we were right, they didn't. So, we did our shorts selection, which is called Mini Muff, and we did the Mentors documentary that was supplied to us by Edwin Oslin, and he gave us that film. And we did those in the CBD at a place called the Colonial Hotel, and those screenings went great, and they were very busy. So that was good. And then we did your screening down at this venue in Moorabbin. But I think next year we'll probably have all the venues in the city again. But this year was a funny year in relation to my controversy, you know, with the same-sex marriage comment that I was involved in last year. David Cole wrote a really good article on that for Taki magazine. You can look that up. And, it was quite... we felt that we needed to have the main venue a bit further out of town just in case we had some political confrontations, which we didn't have. So it's funny, when you stand up to these social justice warriors, when you basically say to them, look, get fucked, we're just going to go ahead and do what we normally do, and you can get stuffed.
Do they mention the SJWs, anything about the film festival online?
We had a couple of protesters. Somebody who has been protesting me for a long time basically said, look, I'm tired of complaining about Richard. You know, he's doing his festival again. I don't like him. But instead of complaining about him, I'm going to start my own. And I actually applaud him for doing that. So he's starting his own festival. I can't remember the name of it right now, but I don't feel the need to promote him anyway. So one of my main critics has decided to get off his ass and do something, which is great. I actually applaud that. So I've always thought, if you have a problem with what I do, go do something else, and or don't attend what I do. And some other idiot online that was to do with, like, you know, we've played a couple of anti-vax films in MUP the last couple of years, and I think this person works for Big Pharma. I mean, you know, I was told that if you play these anti-vax films, there'll be someone from Big Pharma who'll start campaigning against you. So I have this other idiot. I'm not going to name him again. You know, he's written a bit. But they were the only two people who really complained. No one else said boo. You know, I was back on Twitter. I got back on Twitter with the MUF account, and no one really complained. Lauren Southern shared our article. Steve Bannon, Trump at War, which is the official site, he shared our propaganda materials for our screenings. And I know you shared our stuff. So
You
know, everyone seemed pretty happy, you know, and you know, it was all the winners are online. If you go to muff.com.au and you look up the MUF 19 award winners, you'll see all the winners. The best film went to Farmlands by Lauren Southern. Best actor went to Gary Carnes for the film Purgatory Road. Best actress went to Trista Robinson and Gertrude Stamheim for Ulrika's Brain. Best director was shared by Stephen Bannon and Mike Retta, who's a great new filmmaker from South Australia. Best screenplay went to Mark Savage for Purgatory Road and Bruce LaBruce for Ulrika's Brain. The special jury prize to the lesbian and gay community filmmaker Bruce LaBruce, just to show that we're not a homophobic festival, that we do support filmmakers from all different types, and you know, it's always been what MUF's about, just about diversity of opinion rather than the usual diverse bullshit that people like to go on about. Best documentary went to Steve Bannon, Trump at War. Best guerrilla film went to Robert Stark for Supply. And the award for innovation and daring went to Mike Retta, this great new filmmaker, for his new film Youth on the March. So, you know, it was a good selection.
Nice, yeah. What was your criteria for selecting Steve Bannon as best director? I've seen Trump at War, and I definitely don't disagree. I think it's a very well put together and directed film. I just am curious, like, what are some of your thoughts? Because you mentioned it was kind of like a propaganda film. I mean, I think in a lot of ways it is, but as far as it is, it's very good. So
I wanted to give Steve Bannon a personal award. I mean, I think part of me wanted to award someone like Steve Bannon because, and also too, I knew it would really annoy my critics if we were to award Best Film to Farmlands, Best Documentary to Trumpet War, the Special Jury Prize to the LBT, you know, Ulrika's Brain by Bruce to Bruce, and like, you know, Best Guerrilla Film to you guys with Supply. I just knew it would annoy my critics. So
yeah. So some good pragmatic reasons.
You were saying that you did have two more left-wing filmmakers. So as you said before, the overall theme was not so much a political. Wasn't political, just sort of free speech. So giving every filmmaker a chance to express their opinion, regardless of their view.
Definitely, it was about that, and it was like, you know, I mean, the night you guys, they were all kind of films, I guess, of the new right. But the following night, we played, as I said, Bruce LaBruce's film, and he's someone of the far left, the radical far left, and Terry McMahon, he's someone from Ireland. His short won best short. And that's Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. You can watch it online by Terry McMahon. That's about all the kind of, you know, woes of the Irish film industry and the story of the making of his two first features. They're both people of the far left. And, you know, I was quite respectful of them, the way they supported me during all my controversies. And they've been quite loyal. You know, they're saying, look, we don't like Richard's politics, but, you know, we believe in freedom of speech. And you know, I feel the same in relation to what they have to say. You know, I don't agree with their politics, but I'll happily play their work because it's very impressive work in cinema. So that's what we're all about at MUFF, you know, actual diversity of thought and diversity of ideas. And rather than, you know, this political correct bullshit version of diversity, which is really, you know, a different kind of agenda, which I have, you know, obviously, look at my writings at Affirmative Right, Colin Liddell and Andy Nowicki's website. Check that out to see my views on what I think of that version of diversity.
Richard, do you have any thoughts on the recent midterm elections in the United States?
Yes, obviously, I was sad that the Republicans didn't maintain the House. Obviously, I think there's going to be a lot of trouble. I had no idea why people would vote. I mean, you know, I understood that there's a certain amount of Americans who really don't like Trump. And I have some friends on Facebook who, no matter how often I try and put Trump in a positive light, they won't have it. They just can't see anything they like about him, or they don't like his personality, or I don't know. So Trump does awaken a certain negative perspective in some people, and obviously the media has been playing on that for 2 years now, and obviously maybe the Democrats you know, capitalized on that. But I don't know what the Democrats' actual policies are. I mean, do you know one of their policies? I mean, I understand that they don't.
It seems to be like they've gotten so ridiculous, because I do remember, like, back in the Bush era, the left had, like, legitimate issues they were fighting for, like opposing the Iraq War. But now everything is just, like, screaming, Trump's a racist, Trump's a misogynist. Like, they're not actually, they've abandoned all, like, really crucial issues that they did in the past.
You ask them, like, okay, but where is he a racist? I mean, right now that African-American unemployment is at the lowest time in the history of the United States, and then the same is true of Latino-American unemployment. It's at the lowest. I mean, if someone is such a racist, why would he be helping these communities so? I mean, it's so strange. And it's what I call, you know, a fake politics. I was asked to deliver a lecture to a group of Marxist lawyers in the UK on what's called the pseudo-left. They called it the pseudo-left. I call it cultural Marxism. And I had this left-wing Marxist guy on my page for a long time, and he was the head of this conference. And he said, look, I really like what you say about the left. I don't fully agree with a lot of what you say, you know, on immigration, say, or whatever, but can you deliver a talk on what you think is the pseudo-left? And if you go to, if you put in my name, Richard Wollstonecroft, into Google, and then you just go to, like, videos or whatever, and then it's one of the top videos there, you know, and you'll see it. The Discourse on Cultural Marxism. Hang on, what can we... I might better give you the actual name of the video. I'll look it up here quickly. Where the hell is it? Oh, well, it's not on the first page. Is it on the second page? Oh, God. If you can hit this one. Obviously, it's too popular. I don't want people anymore. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead. Ask me another question.
Well, just to comment on that, I agree that the prevailing trend on the left and definitely in the media culture is cultural Marxism and this kind of, you know, Trump's a racist, moral hysteria. And that's a huge problem, and it is the prevailing trend. It remains the prevailing trend within the Democratic Party. However, I do think it's important to be, like, self-critical. And I think one issue that a lot of the Democrats in the areas where they actually won, or, you know, where the actual swing states, but they ran on issues like health care and just appealing to certain demographics in a way that I think the Republicans kind of dropped the ball on a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically, I mean, that is an important issue because one thing that Tucker Carlson actually said on his show is that the Republican Party is just talking about tax cuts, but a large portion of people, like basically the majority now, they don't have the assets even to worry about taxes. You have to give people something tangible. And I actually made the exact same point to this was like prior, long before Trump came around, like an old school Tea Party type about 5 years ago on AM radio. And he was very kind of dismissive about that. So I'm basically, yeah, I was ahead of my time, but you do have to provide something tangible. Yeah, you have to provide something that is tangible to people.
I live in a country where if you fall ill, you go to hospital and it doesn't cost you a cent. If you can have private health insurance, which means you go to a better hospital. But if you fall ill, you go to a fairly decent hospital if you don't have private health insurance, and you basically get fixed up for nothing. And that's covered by a thing called Medicare. And that's paid for by, I guess it's paid for by taxes, and it's something that's been put there in place by the government probably for years, as long as I've been alive. And I actually had a liver disorder when I was in my 27 years of age, and it nearly killed me. And I was very much of a libertarian politics in relation, because I was running the Hellfire Club, which was a very successful nightclub. I was doing quite well. I was only 27 years old. I didn't feel a need to take out health insurance. So when I fell ill with this, you know, particular disease, it was like a liver abscess. It was just like this infection of the liver. But it nearly killed me. And when this saved my life, it really changed my opinion of socialism to an extent that I thought this was a good thing, that this free system existed, and that you can afford it. And people always go, oh, it's going to come from the pockets of the working class and the middle class. Not necessarily. It can come from the pockets of the upper class, and not only that, the mega elite class, the people who have billions and billions of dollars. Now, that's where it should come from. Now, I'm
what we need. That is basically what we need to have in the United States, a healthcare system like that. So,
and I would love to see that, and it really annoys me the way right-wingers, you know, whenever they get any kind of sense of like, oh, mate, gee, we're going to tax maybe ultra-rich people. Why do they want to like help billionaires? Why do right-wing
I don't really get that. Like, all of those ultra-wealthy people are, not all of them, but I'd say maybe at least 90% of them are opposed to any kind of a conservative populist agenda. So it doesn't make any sense whatsoever that you'd want to be like, so concerned.
Why do they want to help people like Soros, the Koch brothers? Why do they want to help these people? Why don't they tax the living shit out of these people so that instead of the extra money that they have, they get to spend influencing and artificially influencing our politics? Why don't they actually get the money these billionaires have and actually have a decent healthcare system?
Yeah, it's basically, I mean, I remember Jim Goad on Tacky Mag. I hate to really dig up like really old stuff, but I remember this, where he criticized you when you said there should be a cap of $100 million per individual. But I mean, that makes sense because you only need about $100 million to have a really lavish lifestyle, but the rest of the money, once you hit that mark, it's basically all the excess wealth is pretty much used to corrupt the political system. So no one really needs more than $100 million. As far as healthcare goes, we definitely need some kind of we need free healthcare, and
need a plan. I mean, I think with the not to be too biased against it, but I think the Republicans' problem right now is they don't. It's not even that they're saying one thing or the other. It's mostly just like, oh, Obamacare didn't work. But there's not. the Republicans are definitely not Trump. Didn't really offer a lot.
No, they basically.
I mean, I like Trump's populist message, but the way he pitches it a lot of the time is actually kind of just the opposite side of the coin of the cultural Marxist message. And both parties, you know, have their big message, and I like one more than the other. Like get it straight. Like I do like Trump's message better. But both parties also need to have a more tangible, you know, end to their politics. And I think Trump's kind of lagging behind on that right now. So,
we basically do need to. Yeah, Republicans are not offering a solution on healthcare. So, I mean, Obamacare is flawed, but Republicans are saying just scrap it and leave people with nothing. But Australia proves the point because. They keep saying, if we have national health care, our economy is going to collapse. But, I mean, Australia, yeah, exactly.
America is the richest country on Earth, and it has the most successful businesses on Earth. Businesses that are so Promethean in relation to producing cash that they're out of this world. The idea that you can't have a basic, semi-decent free healthcare system. I'm totally with Bernie Sanders on this, I have to say. And one of the reasons I like Bernie Sanders is that he actually does bang on about these traditional old left. He doesn't crap on about so much about this, even though he does agree with all of this new identity politics. He's much more of the old left. And I think, you know, I think there's a definite connection between the new right, which I think should embrace a mild socialism, a mild protection net for citizens, and the old left. And I think, you know, when you get a connection like that, this could be quite powerful at the polls. And
absolutely, it could take the country by storm, but it's not happening yet.
So that's basically the problem, is those two groups would have to work together, but the political scene is so divisive that that's not happening.
The Democrats need to embrace the Bernie side of politics. They need to go back to the old right. And the Republicans, who before Trump came along, were all about just helping the wealthy and fuck the poor. They need to embrace, you know, Steve Bannon's economic nationalism, which is more about helping the local working class and middle class, right? And I think, you know, that gives both sides of politics a bit of heart, a bit of populist pull. And once you have that, then you're going to have a legitimate fight politically. But right now we're caught between a rock and a hard place as both parties are undergoing change. And I think Bernie Sanders and Trump are doing great things within each party to actually give these parties something of a heart again. And I think that's what all this politics and what's, I guess, described between, you know, it's nationalists or people who believe in helping the local working class and the local middle class versus globalists who just believe in helping the mega elite dominate and control and manipulate this kind of global feudalism that's being promoted as somehow positive, which is absolutely not a vote winner. That's why that's populist. Who the fuck wants to vote for that? No one.
I mean, that gets to the reason why Republicans lost to Congress, and it's not. I mean, the defeat wasn't as bad as the media was predicting. No, but the media was saying, they lost because of Trump's divisive, racist rhetoric. But no, I mean, the reason that Republicans lost was because they went more with Paul Ryan's agenda of focusing on tax cuts for the top wealthiest and deregulation of big corporations rather than the original the nationalist and populist message that Trump has laid out. So I think the important thing about Trump is his symbolism as pushing expanding the Overton window, but as far as what's actually been accomplished, I mean, that's a different situation, and just going into the future. So, I mean, what Trump has to do to be successful if he wants to get reelected, I am feeling pessimistic about Trump's chances of being reelected in 2020. But it's way too early to tell. And I think for Trump to be successful, he will have to obviously find a way to stay strong on the immigration issue. And that's going to be tough.
And he's just got to bring the message home and make it tangible, make it real. Whether it's the populist message about immigration, you know, actually building the wall, that's something he's of course got to do. But also, I think in terms of everything, in terms of what we're going to do about healthcare, in terms of, you know, hopefully moving away from some of the more typical Republican, mainstream Republican tax cuts and such.
So yeah, I would like to see Trump do is work out some deal with the Democrats. So let's say like we get some kind of healthcare bill that finds a way to grant people affordable healthcare and also invest invest more in infrastructure and do things that are compatible with the populist left, but then in exchange get support for immigration restriction and building the wall. I mean, that's what I'd like to see ideally is realistically, I think what's most likely to happen is that we're just going to see a lot of gridlock the next 2 years.
I think that's the important thing. If Trump is smart right now, he will reach out to the decent side of the Democratic Party, which I consider is Bernie Sanders and a few people around him that want to do something with healthcare, and he could maybe use that as a horse trading. Say, okay, let's give Bernie his healthcare, and then for that, maybe I get my wall, and that's maybe some kind of compromise.
I would also say, I mean, those things kind of go together in my mind. Obviously, the wall is more of a symbol, but if you're going to be giving away. If you're going to have universal health care, that you can't have that and open borders. It simply doesn't work. So, I mean, to me, these things go hand in hand. It's barely a compromise.
I mean, because just looking at future trends, a big issue in the future is going to be automation. And with automation, I mean, that will mean a basic income will be absolutely necessary, and we will need more socialism. But the thing about having socialism, socialism can be a good thing. But at the same time, if you're going to have socialism, you can't keep importing a larger underclass. You have to deal with that issue first.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say with socialism, the main thing, definitely not keeping importing many and many people. You have to kind of combine it with a form of nationalism in order for it to work at all. And also, there's other issues with socialism. Like, I would not call myself a socialist. I think there's certain socialistic policies which can be used as an effective tool in order to, get the right cultural sort of outcomes.
I don't know if Richard is familiar with this concept, but would you say a good agenda would be smart socialism?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about, smart socialism. In the broad strokes, just simply socialism which redistributes wealth to the most productive or most potentially productive members of society rather than the least. So kind of avoiding welfareism.
I agree with that. And I guess that was the kind of idea that I was talking to Jim Goad about when he nearly kicked me out of his car on the way to the airport. But look, for example, the reason I was pitching this to Jim was because, I just spent about a week making his sections of The Second Coming, Volume 2, and I really like Jim. I mean, he's not someone who's that easy to get along with, but, I mean, he's actually quite a nice person. When you hang out with him, he's quite loyal and... he's, when he's your friend kind of thing. And I never meant my opinions to offend him. But, he's someone, he had a what's it called, a brain tumor about 5 or 10 years ago. And I remember seeing that on social media, and I was concerned about him. And it's the kind of thing that could recur. And I was talking about the whole issue to him because I care about the guy. And, I would like to see if he ever had a medical emergency, no matter what it was, I would like to see it repaired without much cost to him. I think he does have decent health insurance. I'm not sure. I have no idea about his personal situation, but that was the reason I was talking to him about it. So it did strike me as unusual when he attacked me because,
Well, it was an interesting story because I didn't know you at the time. So I had this kind of image that you were this effete, upper class, wealthy liberal.
I've always struggled for everything I have. I mean, I run independent businesses in this country. The Health Fire Club was a very successful business that enabled me to start the Melbourne Underground Film Festival. These are all independent events. Occasionally I've had a little bit of help from my family, but I'm not Richard Spencer. I'm not sitting on $1 million trust fund, a multi-million-dollar trust fund. I'm always just struggling like most people. So the idea that I'm in this ultra elite class, but yes, I have been lucky. I have been able to travel just about every year since I started the Hellfire Club in '92. I either go overseas to America or Europe, or if I'm saving money, maybe I'll go to Bali like I did this year. So which is a lot cheaper holiday. But anyway, look, I say these things. I add them to the kind of, I guess, I just want to, you know, broaden the discussion, particularly on the right, that not every form of socialism is Stalin or Chairman Mao, that you can have a mild one where you're taxing the mega elite, basically the globalists, who we all don't like, right? We don't like the globalists. Who cares if they lose a few billion dollars, right? You know, why don't we tax them a little bit and actually ease the burden on the working class and the middle class? And I don't see there's a problem with that. And look, I understand there are people who have economic libertarian views that are quite stringent. Someone like Jim does have those views. And that's fine. It's a dialogue. But I certainly never meant my views to offend him. And I was only talking about them really out of friendship to his own position. You know, that's what it's about, really. And I just want to say to all right-wingers out there, don't view every form of socialism. You can have mild socialism, the socialism that we have in Australia, where, you know, you can go to university and you can defer the payment with HECS, you know, and it's not as expensive.
And the thing is, Australia, it's a very, at the same time, it's also a very pro-business country. There's a lot of commerce there, so the two can coexist perfectly.
You know, and the idea that it wouldn't work in a country like America is just a fiction, because if anything, America is a more financially successful country than Australia and even Sweden, where these vaguely socialist kind of support systems exist. I just think America can have this. It can have its cake and eat it too a little bit. But yeah, it's going to have to maybe tax the mega elite or the upper class a little bit more, and maybe also make the businesses, the very successful businesses like Apple and other huge corporations that make trillions of dollars out of America, maybe tax them a little bit more, you know, and actually put their investment back into the country. And then I think you will see this will be great for all Americans, because you'll be boosting education. When you look after health and education, you look after the well-being of the great, you know, the people like you, mate, you know, like you guys, right? You know, who've got great minds and who are the great thinkers of the future, who are going to think our way through future political situations and problems. You're going to continue to make films. You're going to contribute great things to your country. So these are the people we want to look after. So
in order to encourage innovation and both creative endeavors, political, intellectuals, and technological innovation, you do need that social safety net so that those people are supported.
I think so, and I think right-wingers should not oppose it. I had a big argument with Jeffrey Tucker about this, and I wrote an article on affirmative right called Economic Libertarianism. Economic Libertarianism is Plutocratic Collectivism. You can look that up. It's on affirmative right. So just go to affirmative right and Google my name or whatever, and you'll see all the essays I've written. That's one of my better essays. That got widely spread by people. A couple of them have been shared by Alexander Dugan. One where I talked about the new multiculturalism is actually racist, and that the anti-immigration stance is actually non-racist, and I kind of flipped the paradigm on them. And that's another interesting essay. I know Alexander Dugan did share that one. So it's all very interesting. I think it's all part of this broad discussion we're having, and it's a lot of fun.
Well, I do want to talk about Bolsonaro in Brazil, because I mean this is very significant, because Brazil is a country that's long elected leftist leaders, and basically Brazil represents the future demographics of the United States as things are headed. So it is remarkable to see a country that, I mean, right-wingers always say, oh yeah, Brazil is America in 100 years, but they elected a very right-wing president. But the problem is with Brazil is a very different situation. So America and Australia still have very strong... the middle class is declining, but it's still the dominant group, and there's a whole angle of a smart socialism. So, I do have some reservations about Bolsonaro, but on the record, if I were Brazilian, I would definitely vote for him. But the problem is, I mean, what do you do in a country like Brazil, where basically the divide is between you have a large underclass and a small elite, and maybe a small to medium-sized middle class? So a lot of these ideas that we're talking about are most effective in a nation that is still somewhat homogenous and mostly middle class. But how do you address these problems in a nation basically like Brazil, where the majority of people are underclass?
Well, I don't know. I mean, Bolsonaro, there's always the accusation that some of these new right leaders are fascist. I mean, you know, maybe with Bolsonaro, that might not be completely unfair. He's certainly spoken some kind of fascist kind of ideas. I mean, you know, I remember when he won, it was a bit of like a fire up the helicopters time. You know, kind of memes were being shared around Facebook. You know, there's something of Pinochet about him. Sometimes that kind of Pinochet right-wing Latin American dictator, I can have problems with someone like that, because I just think they become insane a little bit, you know, and I don't know what Bolsonaro is going to do. I think if he remains a moderate version of the right, I would certainly support him. If he remains like a Brazilian version of Trump, then I think, you know, he's on the right track. If he goes into Pinochet, where he does fire up the helicopters, well, I think that could be a problem. I don't support these kind of atrocities that have been heard under the name of the extreme right in the 20th century. I don't think anyone on the new right or the alt-right should even be applauding this kind of stuff, outside of a few jokes and a few fun memes involving helicopters, maybe. But, we can have our fun with the helicopter memes, but, like, really, you really want to be doing that to people? I don't think so. So, I think, yeah, look, it remains to be seen. But, yes, it's all part of this broader turn to the new right, the turn to the strong men, turn to, right-wing nationalist populism.
But the question, question about Bolsonaro, I mean, will he be a more national populist agenda that we're more interested in, or will he just be the continuation of this kind of a Latin American oligarchic system where wealth is concentrated in the top and most people are poor, which is basically the situation in a lot of those countries? I do admire a lot of things about Juan Perón in Argentina, but Argentina's a different situation because it's a much more European society than Brazil.
Don't get me wrong. I mean, there are some things about these Latin American dictators like Perón that I've admired. I've always had a bit of a soft spot for Latin American dictators, let's say. So I don't know. I mean, but I like Castro as well, you see. So I confuse people. I like Castro as well. And I'm reading the new book by Zizek, like a thief in broad daylight at the moment. So, you know, I read the Marxists and I read these new communists. So, and I'm attracted to both ideas on the far right and on the far left. And I guess I'm interested in the kind of dialectic between radical ideas, radical centrism, some have called it. And we've discussed this idea here on your podcast. So, you know, I think it's just about keeping open to interesting ideas that can change the status quo from any side of politics in an interesting way that will help. The class I really like is the middle class. I guess that's the class I'm from. And also the working class, because I think when you have a decent, happy, productive working class, everybody is happy, including the fucking upper class. If upper class were smart, they should know they got to look after the working class, and particularly the middle class, because we're the fucking meat in the sandwich. You know, people like you and I, the three of us here, I guess we would probably count as middle class, right? And that we are the sandwich. We stop them being beheaded and, you know, the next fucking French Revolution. So, you know, looking after the middle class is very important. We're the buffer zone.
That's the key to having a healthy, stable society. So, I mean, that's Absolutely. kind of the problem with Brazil is they're already in a situation where the United States is we have the middle class, but we have this concern that we're going to end up like Brazil, but Brazil basically already is there. So that problem is, I mean, how do you address those issues in a situation like that? So I'll go over a few of Bolsonaro's issues. So he does talk about cracking down on immigration from. So Brazil is getting a lot of immigrants from Haiti, Africa, and the Middle East, and a lot of them are actually using Brazil as a stepping point to get to the United States, so that's beneficial to us, or they're just staying in Brazil. And that's also an important issue for Brazil because those people coming in from Haiti and Africa make things even worse for working class Brazilians. And Bolsonaro wants to end affirmative action. That's good. But the one thing actually I do find really disturbing about him is I read that he wants to open up the rainforest to logging, because that would be a disaster if that were true.
I agree, and I think that the right wing again has made a mistake here. The way that they oppose any form of vaguely reasonable socialism, like we spoke about before, also environmentally, whether you believe in global warming or not, which I actually don't believe in it. But it's still quite clear when you travel the world, as I have, that we're destroying the fucking planet. The way that, like, like plastics in the oceans, and it's just overpopulation, and just hideous the way we are polluting the environment.
Yeah, isn't there some giant? I mean, there's like this giant plastic landmass.
Plastic island.
In the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
It's like bigger than Hawaii. It's huge. Yeah.
You know, there's this meme online that I think left wing people share. It says conservatives. You know, what do they conserve? And I think that's a really spot on criticism. If you're conservative, you're about conserving things, and I think conserving the natural environment should be a really big part of what the right wing should be about. And I think we've been letting the team down on the right, that we are not as environmentally conscious. Now, it doesn't mean embracing every load of bullshit, you know, that comes down the line from the globalists and the United Nations about embracing wind, which can be more expensive, whatever. But there are ways to clean up. There are ways to clean up the oceans. There are just a lot of things we can be doing, and there are a lot of money we could spend there that would be extremely beneficial, replanting trees and just, I don't know. I'm not a fucking environmentalist, but we could engage in really interesting and healthy debate with and the way that both Trump and Bolsonaro just seem to be allowing big business to kind of rape and pillage the environment even further, I think it's a terrible idea, and I think both are making a mistake there.
Yeah, and also think, I mean, it's the right thing to do because the Republicans have, there's a whole kind of a Koch brothers agenda, which just is about getting rid of environmental regulations for business interests. But, I mean, some of it is Trump's personal bias in real estate, because I know when he was a real estate developer about a decade ago, he destroyed a forest in Northern Virginia for a golf course. So a lot of it has to do with his personal bias. So, I mean, it's really important to protect places like the rainforest. But just as an electoral strategy, I think Republicans really need to win over the kind of demographic of middle to upper middle class, like well-educated white voters with college degrees. And I think one of the reasons why they've lost that demographic is, I mean, the media will put out the propaganda, oh, it's because of for all these this politically correct nonsense. But the real reason, or at least a main reason, is that the Republicans have taken this really strong anti-environmental stance. So just from a standpoint of political strategy, you would win over a lot more, much larger demographic.
Very well said. Very well said, Robert. I think that's an extremely good point. And I think that, yes, Trump does sometimes have support from these university-educated white folks, who do have an environmental conscience. And when they see him behaving so irresponsibly, I think that's not a good sign. It's part of, you know, effective leadership to be cohesive across the spectrum. So I think in the next 2 years, Trump has to do something on the environment. He has to do something on health. I think if he can do that with the Democrat Republican House, I think you're going to, you know, see some interesting change. And maybe they'll give him his wall, but I wouldn't hold your breath. But
yeah.
You know, look, it's all part of this, look, you know, in a lot of ways, I've just been reading Slavoj Zizek. He talks about, you know, how capitalism is failing, and there's something connected to, with, you know, neoliberalism and capitalism. It is collapsing to a certain extent, and that these grander narratives of the right and the left are beginning to take hold again. I guess the right is nationalism and the left is socialism, right? So, you know, these grand narratives are beginning to reappear. As if history has re-begun again to kind of contravene Francis Fukuyama. So I think, you know, this is a very interesting time to be alive, and it's a very interesting time to be contributing to the political discourse space. So, you know, I think that's great, boys.
Before I wrap up the show, Richard, is there anything else you'd like to add about the success of Muff? First Muff since what happened earlier this year with the censorship.
Well, it was an important year for the festival to continue fighting and continue supporting independent cinema and continue having a truly diverse voice in relation to different political ideas at the festival. I think we did that this year. I want to thank you both for giving me your film, and I hope you enjoy your award. So I think it's well deserved, and I wanted to thank you in person on this show for giving us your film and congratulate you on winning. And you know, I think it's been a great year, and I've also been asking a few other people to come on this podcast. I actually got in contact with Boyd Rice's girlfriend, Karen Bookbinder, so I'm trying to get Boyd Rice through. I'm not sure if he'll do it, but I'll probably let you know in the next week, and if I do, I'll introduce you, Robert, to Karen on Facebook. Actually, I can't do that. We'll do it over email, because I'm blocked on Facebook. But my second page is going to be back online in 3 days. So at the moment, I'm in radio silence on both my pages for the next 3 days.
Jeez.
running them back. So isn't this unbelievable? In unbelievable times we live in.
Richard Wollstonecraft, it has been an excellent show, and thank you for being on, and thank you and everyone at Muff for our supply.
It's our pleasure. Namaste, boys. Have fun.
Take care.
See ya.